Okay, I guess I'll go ahead and get started. This will be somewhat like Shelley's talk the other day. I think the idea is for me to give somewhat of a tutorial at the beginning on evolution. I know everybody thinks they understand evolution. It's the easiest thing in the world, but you know, a fourth grader can be taught natural selection, but that's not what it's all about, it turns out. This conference is about energy, so I'll be trying to link energetic cost of various features at the cellular level to evolutionary theory. Before I get started, I want to look, so these guys here are some of the people that I've been working with that will have contributed to some of the topics that I hope I eventually get to when I start talking about applications of the evolutionary ideas. Greg works at a thing called the BioHub. I moved to this place called the BioDesign Institute a couple of years ago. We were starting a thing called the Center for Mechanisms of Evolution. At first, I didn't like this word biodesign a whole lot because we have this problem with intelligent design and biology. I've sort of gotten over it. And I'll point out, too, that there's sort of a review paper that some of us have put together, including Rob in the back there and one of his former grad students, Jita. That you can find there if you want to just sort of get a little more of the nuts and bolts background to estimating cost of cells. So this is sort of the roadmap where we're going. I've been delighted to have been at the KITP, I think, four or five times before, and have probably learned more than I did my entire graduate career in these times. But I also know how long these talks can go. So I prepared a 10-minute talk, and I hopefully it in 2 hours or hour and a half. But this is sort of where we're going. I want to first talk about, make sure everybody's on the same page about the mechanisms of evolution, in particular the role of noise in the evolutionary process. I'll eventually get to talking about the currency for estimating cost of things at the cell level. This is an energy meeting, but I think it's probably at least worth discussing the alternatives. I don't have any solutions for that. And then I'll go into some methods for actually figuring out how much it costs in terms of ATP hydrolysis to build various things in cells, and also to build entire cells. And then ultimately, because we're trying to connect now with evolution and how energetics drives differences in evolutionary trajectories in different phylogenetic lineages, we have to convert back to fitness. So that will complete the link here. And then I'm hopeful that I get to the end of my talk. And throughout my talk, I'll be talking about general scaling laws in biology and cell biology in particular. And, you know, we have to be loose with this word law. There's statistical relationships. And these are the things, some of the things we'd like to explain. I'll talk about the cost of a gene and how this relates to really different levels of complexity in genome architecture across the tree of life. Some stuff that I've been recently involved in is figuring out how much it costs to make membranes on cells and all the internal membranes that set us apart from prokaryotes. And then finally, I'll talk about the cost of motility in particular, I guess in just the cost of swimming in microbes. So I like to start out with this slide to set the course straight here. Most of evolutionary biology, or what people think is evolutionary biology, is all about focusing on optimal solutions, and everything is perfectly designed, and there's this great quote that goes back to Darwin that explains all of this. And, you know, just to think about this, suppose you're an alien biologist that landed down at the Earth, unfortunately, on one of the poles, and you found all this diversity and beauty. Right? If it's beautiful and diverse, it must have been driven by natural selection. Spend, you know, a decade trying to figure out what's driving this diversification. You know, maybe these are anti-predator adaptations, all these little pointy things, or maybe they're for attracting mates. That doesn't work out so well because these don't even seem to be sexual. Maybe they're anti-buoyancy or buoyancy adaptations and so on. And you've done this for like 40 years. And then some graduate student next door to your lab walks in and informs you that, professor, these you check the carbon content of these things, and you collapse into a heap on the floor, having done this adaptationist paradigm for so long. This is one of the most common quotes of Darwin. You can, about every 10th paper in the journal Cell, on the most arcane aspect of cell biology, you can find this quote, which makes it all legitimate. So what natural selection, so natural selection, I think, is one of the most powerful forces in the biological world, but it's not all powerful. And what dictates what selection can and can't do in different lineages is governed by what I call the population genetic environment. And that has three dimensions here. Mutation, of course, creates all the variation upon which natural selection has to operate. Mutation is, in fact, quite a bit biased at the nucleotide level and higher levels in organisms. It's random with respect to what selection would like to have happen, but it's certainly biased at the molecular level. Recombination reassorts variation within among chromosomes. And then random genetic drift is the noise in the evolutionary process. And all these things make a big difference because the power of these things varies by about four orders of magnitude among different phylogenetic lineages. And it turns out that many aspects of molecular genome evolution are functions of the ratios of these things. So that's even more orders of magnitude. Some cases we have to worry about. And I'll go through, you know, the relative values of these things in a few minutes. But to set things, the course straight for the rest of what I want to talk about, especially in getting into the noise in the evolutionary process, I like to use this plot here. So imagine you have some trait that's in all organisms, let's say. There are a few such traits, like replication fidelity and metabolism and so on, and that it's and natural selection is relentlessly pushing in an upward manner. This might be the catalytic rate of some key enzyme, if you like. And the idea here is that you're trying to get here. This is some measure of molecular perfection, if you let me use this loosely. That might be the maximum catalytic rate that could be achieved by an enzyme, which would be, I guess, dictated by the diffusion rate of the substrate or something like that. So selection's always pushing you in an upward manner, no matter what species you are. This is an internal cellular trait. But as the population size gets smaller and smaller, you're competing, selection's competing with this noise in the evolutionary process. And once you get to the point where the power of selection is matched by the noise created by natural selection, then natural selection's eyes are sort of glazed over. You just can't go any farther. And so this is what I call the drift barrier. So this is the limits to what natural selection can accomplish. So it's important for us to know what this thing, the effective population size is. And as I'll point out in a few minutes, this is not equivalent to the census size of an organism. It's really driven by lots of different genetic aspects, including the fact our genes aren't.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So the downward force you have said is genetic drift, mutation bias.
Yeah.
Why not constraints of the environment? And
well, that's an open question. You know, what do we even mean by physical constraints and traits? But that you might put that up into this. That would be the level of molecular perfection you can reach.
For a given set of constraints.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if you intentionally do that or it's just a joint thing. When the effective size goes to infinity, does the limit go to the biophysical limit? That's the limit to the natural selection.
Well, it won't get quite there because there's always reverse mutation going on. Even if you're an infinite population size, there'll always be, you know, you'll be dominated by the beneficial allele, but there's always, each generation, going to be deleterious alleles coming in.
Do you think the gap is not a finite size effect?
We're pretty far from infinity, as I'll show you. I mean, I guess we're always far from infinity, but I'll give you an idea how close to infinity. I'm using bad language here in front of physicists, I guess. But,
we think that limit all the time. I would have said that we're always very close to infinity.
Okay, well, I'll show you how close we are then.
So how do you work into this, the fact that at some point any particular molecule is going to get good enough that it's no longer limiting fitness and it's somebody else's limiting fitness?
Oh, well, that might be true, but I mean, selection should still operate on each individual gene at the same time. I think you're thinking about this sort of in a limiting nutrient sort of way, maybe.
No, I'm thinking so what is it that limits fitness at any one time? It's not, I mean, some random enzyme or protein is probably not the limiting factor. I don't know what the limiting factor is, but once it's not limiting, then natural selection is not going to keep improving it.
Yeah, I have a hard time thinking. I think I see what you're saying, but I sort of view all genes as contributing to fitness, and of course there can be interactions. So I suppose if you had some kind of interaction, you could get to the point where it doesn't matter. As long as you're up here for one gene, it doesn't matter that the fine adjustments would be made somewhere else. But
because I usually think of this kind of picture more in terms of fitness of the organism, which is,
yeah,
it's a function of many different things, but the,
right,
not all of them are actually being seen by natural selection because they're good enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to present the cartoon version of this just to give you a general idea. I want to make sure everybody understands what genetic drift is, and it's not this mystical force. That's the main place I'm heading at this point. And the main way I wanted to look at this, the way you would think about this is evolution is a stochastic process. So imagine you had the luxury of studying species at different points along here over time and then recording what their value for the trait was. If you're way down here, there's going to be some long-term steady, I think steady state is the word that physicists would use, distribution. We like to call it a quasi-steady state distribution, but because drift is occurring and mutations occurring, if you took a snapshot of your population at different times, it would have slightly different values, and there'd be some long-term overall distribution. And then as you move way over here, there'd be these distributions, but you'd be hugging the, you know, you'd be getting up closer to molecular perfection. So that's kind of the idea. And some of the theory we're working on is trying to figure out where these kind of relationships reside. So random genetic drift. This is the simplest cartoon version of random genetic drift. It's a bit oversimplified, but I want to make sure everybody understands that. Oh yeah, I'm supposed to apologize now for using the word drift, because there's a lot of physicists in the room. And when did physicists start using the word drift?
No, I mean, it's Einstein had the word drift.
19 what?
1905.
Okay, so that's before we started using it, so apologies. We've been using it for a long time.
And you've got genetic in front of you. You don't have to apologize.
What's that?
You've got genetic up there. It's genetic drift.
Yeah, it's genetic drift, but the point here is that our genetic drift is a random process, and in physics, drift is the directional force.
Right.
So this is like it's a bit
opposite.
Yeah. So when I use drift, it's in, flip it around in your physics head.
It's okay. You have the random process is biased.
Yeah.
You could just still call it a random.
Right. Process. But this is not supposed to be biased. So let's start with a small population. This is a single genetic locus, and there's two flavors of the allele. There's the black ball and the white ball here. And then this population has a gamete storm, so everybody produces lots of random gametes, and then they randomly unite. The environmental host 10 individuals in this case. And you can see that the allele we just grabbed the random balls out of there, and by chance, it's just binomial sampling at this point. We got a 0.6. And then we go through this process over and over again. These numbers fluctuate around. Eventually, we'll get to the point where the frequency of the white ball is either 1.0 or 0.0. We'll just lose it. And the only way back would be by a back mutation. And when you go to completion of or a frequency of 1 for something, we call that fixation of the allele. Now, what I want to emphasize, I mean, this is obviously a endangered species issue over here with only 10 individuals. But what I want to emphasize is that the general principles of random genetic drift apply regardless of what the population size is. It's just that the magnitude of the fluctuations is inversely proportional to the population size. Okay? Just like the probability of getting a point of a certain draw on flipping a coin, the standard error around there is inversely proportional to the number of times you flip the coin. So that's sort of the idea. So if we had a population size of 25 here, this is just one random trajectory that might happen over time. And you can see after about 30 generations, it went to fixation. It could have just as easily gone to that in that direction, assuming there's no selection driving you one way or another. And then we increase the population size by a factor of 10. And you can see the fluctuations are still there, but they're 10 times smaller. And it takes 10 times longer to get to the same point that you would get here. And then we go to 2,500, and the fluctuations are still 10 times smaller. And so the time scale of the whole process is just proportional to, there's 1 over n, 1 over the population size, okay? So this applies to all populations of all, provided you're finite, and we're in biology world here, so everything is in fact finite population size. So that's the way we like to start talking about random genetic drift, but it turns out that once the numbers of individuals get moderately large, i.e. more than about 10,000 individuals, which isn't that large, most of the noise in the evolutionary process is no longer due to numbers of individuals. Most of the stochasticity is due to the way our genomes are constructed, the fact our genes are glued together on chromosomes. That means a mutation here's fate is strongly tied to all the other mutations that happen to be segregating at the population at link sites. And that can be seen here. So again, a population size of 10. These little tick marks, these are variable. You can think about this as a DNA sequence, and these are the places where there's variation in the population. These three guys happen to have all the same nucleotide. And what's happened here is that a mutation arose here at that site, and it was a beneficial mutation. It's so good that over some period of time, it was driven to by fixation, by positive selection. And since the population size is fixed at 10 here, all these other variants were left behind. They were eliminated from the population. So that's as though in this chromosomal region, there was a population bottleneck in some sense, right? There's always been 10 individuals, but genetically, it's as though a population bottleneck had occurred. And I want to point out that other things can happen here. So this is good. This is adaptive evolution. You fixed a beneficial mutation that wasn't there before. But in the process, there was this mutation over here, what I've labeled with a red ball here, that turned out to be another beneficial mutation. But it wasn't quite as good as this one. So as this one went to fixation, that one was left behind. It's on a different chromosome, and it has no way to get recombined in this small chromosomal segment. And then there's this guy over here, which I've illustrated, I think, with the green ball here. That's actually a deleterious mutation. It's a mildly deleterious mutation. It's not as good as this one, but the net advantage of this chromosomal segment is still, it's got a selective advantage greater than zero, so selection could still move it to fixation. Now, this is a problem with chromosome structure, and if all these nucleotides happened to be on different chromosomes, this wouldn't have been, and it was a sexually reproducing organism, this wouldn't have been a problem. We could have fixed both beneficial mutations, and purifying selection would have eliminated the deleterious mutation. So chromosomal structure also causes a lot of stochasticity in evolution. It really depends on who you land next to when you arise as a new mutation. And for large populations, this is the primary source of noise, I think, in genetic transmission from generation to generation. So let's think now about some numbers. So the problem here is, as I just said, recombination. So if you had a lot of recombination, this would be good because it enables selection to see each mutation for its own, based on its own properties. So how do we think about recombination? Well, we have a lot of good information on the average rates of recombination per nucleotide site in genomes. They come from making what people call genetic maps. I won't go into the details, but if you cross different organisms, you have markers, and then look in the progeny, you can figure out the rate of recombination. You start with a double heterozygote, and then you can figure out the ways in which you get the four different outcomes in gametes. And so there's tons of this work done, especially in things of agricultural importance, but also in a lot of unicellular species. And what I plotted here is the recombination rate per kilobase, 1,000 bases of DNA, that would be per meiosis. So these are crossover recombination rates as a function of genome size. And you can maybe see here, this is a log-log plot, and the slope here is -1. And this is a general principle. So the problem is if you live down here, you're already a big organism with small population size, and your recombination rate is quite low. If you live over here, that's yeast. That's Saccharomyces cerevisiae. That's really the most recombinant organism that we're familiar with on the planet. But why this negative relationship? This turns out to be very... This is sort of could be done in, be a good question for your general biology course if you teach it. show them this graph and then ask why this, don't show them this part, but ask them why this falls out this way. And there's a very simple reason. It's because as organisms get larger and larger, their genome size get larger and larger. I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But it's not because they add more chromosomes. It's just because the average chromosome size is getting larger. And there's this rule in genetics, and we don't really understand where this came from, but it's, you know, one of these gifts from the gods, and that is there's about one crossover per chromosome arm, regardless of what phylogenetic lineage you live in, eukaryotes. So if you double the length of the chromosome, you reduce the amount of recombination per physical distance. Okay, simple as that. So that's where you get this negative slope. And you get some variation here because some organisms have more chromosomes than others. But so a simple way to get this number is just take the average chromosome length of your organism and divide by two, one crossover per arm. And that's more or less how you get these numbers. So about 99% of the variation in recombination rates among organisms across the tree of eukaryotic life is simply determined by chromosome size. Simple as that. I have a lot of colleagues who spend their whole careers trying to understand the evolutionary sources of differences in recombination among organisms and argue that it's due to adaptive evolutionary advantages of high, low recombination rates, but there you go. That seems to be a nice physical a law in biology, what we might call a rule of life.
Can I ask a question?
Okay.
I understood from your previous slide what's the problem of having a too small recombination rate. But what would be the problem of having it too large?
I guess if you were a yeast cell and you had, 12 million bases, it might be a problem if each base was a single chromosome. I guess you have to have telomeres and a few other things in there. But probably there would be problems you'd eventually run into having a nice organized meiosis if you have too many chromosomes.
Having a higher recombination rate instead of number of chromosomes, really.
Oh, having a higher and higher recombination rate than that? I don't know. Why? That's a very good question. The fact that this is a rule across the tree of life suggests natural selection is doing everything possible to reduce the amount of crossing over to a minimum. That's my interpretation of it, right? People who do cytogenetics argue you have to have at least one crossover per chromosome arm to have an organized meiosis, but that can't strictly be true, right? Christy works on flies, and half the flies in the world, the males,
don't
recombine. So it's an open question.
Meiosis, yeah.
Why isn't the rate even higher? I think it's because selection, for some reason, is trying to minimize it.
But every rule has exception, especially in biology.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, everything. I mean, Greg just gave a whole seminar on that.
So budding yeast is up in the corner.
Yeah, that's budding yeast.
Fission yeast on the bottom?
No, these are, all these purple points are unicellular eukaryotes, so I don't know where fission yeast is. Maybe that point. Chlamydomonas would be up there, a lot of other. These words are probably not making any sense to the physicist in the room. Everybody knows Chlamydomonas?
Okay. Clammy, right?
Clammy. Okay. Not to be confused with chlamydia. Okay, so what about this effective population size? This is a pretty big number, and it's one of the more difficult things we have to measure in population genetics. So ideally, you would go back to the theory I talked about, and you would just study the fluctuations in allele frequency over time in your population, and then work backwards and estimate the effective population size that would be required to give that fluctuation. But the problem is, you have to estimate exactly what the allele frequency is, and having large enough sample sizes to do that is impossible. So what we do instead is we try to think about the equilibrium level of genetic variation that would be in a population, given a certain power of drift and a certain power of mutation. We're forgetting about selection here, which is potentially a problem, but here we work on sites that we think are under minimal selection. And you had an introduction a bit from Greg on this. So there are, I think, 7 amino acids for which the third position, as long as you're not Greg's virus, the third position, you can have any one of four nucleotides, and you still encode for the same amino acid. So we call the, that's why we call these silent or synonymous sites, that was the word Greg used earlier. And if this is truly a silent site, then there's a simple explanation for how much variation you'd expect in a population. So imagine we keep the population size constant, and we're talking about the standing level of variation in the population. By what we mean by that is we take two random genes and compare them at this site. We ask, are the two nucleotides different? They're just randomly sampled from individuals. And if they start out identical, new variations introduced at this site equal to twice the mutation rate per site. Twice, because we're comparing two sequences. Okay, each one's mutating at rate U. And then by definition, the rate of loss of variation is equal to 1 over 2NE. NE is our effective population size. The 2 is there because of, I'm assuming diploidy here. If you had a haploid organism, the 2 wouldn't be there. But that would be the rate of loss of genetic variation, and that would be the rate of input. And if you let this go for a while, it's just like an input-output diagram in a nutrient budget or something. It will reach equilibrium. And that equilibrium is equal to, very closely equal, approximated by 4 NEU. So that's pretty good news. It's a simple explanation. The bad news is we want to estimate NE, but this thing, we do this, people do this all the time. You measure silent site variation. This has been measured in hundreds of species. But if you want to get NE, you have to set your standing variation equal to this and solve, but in order to get a solution, you need to know the mutation rate of your organism. And that's a very difficult thing to do as well. But my lab has been working on mutation rates in various organisms for at least 10 years or so. And so I'm not going to go through how we do this, but it's based on very large, long-term mutation accumulation experiments where everybody starts identical. They go through a bottleneck of one individual each generation, and in the end we sequence the genomes. And so we count usually 300 or 400 mutations. We get really good estimates in mutation rate. So I factored out the mutation rate for about, I don't know, about 40 organisms or so. And I just want to show you the general scaling relationship between effective population size and the size of an organism. So I think the So again, it's a log-log plot. I think the slope there is around minus 0.15. And we're all down here. Us vertebrates are all down here. And then we go into land plants. See, we're moving to the left. We're getting to smaller and smaller organisms. Invertebrates, unicellular eukaryotes, and bacteria. A couple points I want to make with this plot here is this really relates to the efficiency of natural selection. So if you live down here and you have an effective size of about 10 to the fourth individuals, which is the long-term historical effective size in the human population, it's certainly not that today, but historically 10,000 years ago, that was sort of the rough effective population size of humans. What that means is that if you take the inverse of the effective size, that's the drift barrier. So if your population size is 10 to the fourth, that means if you have a mutation with an effect smaller, than, or absolute value smaller than 10 to the minus four, that's a pretty big effect actually, but natural selection can't see it because the deterministic force of selection is overwhelmed by the stochastic force of random genetic drift. So that means if you live way down here, you can only use in adaptive evolution mutations that have effects greater than 10 to the minus 4. And you can't purge deleterious mutations with effects smaller than 10 to the minus 4.
So for any particular species, if you were to look for intra-species, individual-to-individual variability, how do you expect that scaling to look?
Individual to individual variability.
Oh, from the same species.
Mm-hmm.
So if we zoom in on, let's say, a blue point which corresponds to one species, and plot many blue points corresponding to different individuals of that species.
Yeah, each one of these is for a different species. So if we looked at, maybe one way to answer it is if we look at randomly uniting gametes, that's what we would look at. So if we look at, we sequence your genome, your mom gave you half your chromosomes and your dad gave you the other half. In humans, the variation is about 0.001. So about one, and if we went down all your chromosomes, about 1 in 1,000 nucleotides in your chromosome, you would be different from mom and dad. That's sort of the level in humans. And for most organisms, it rarely ever gets greater than about 2%. And I'll hopefully explain why in a second.
I have a question.
Yeah.
How do you define that effect? It affects less than 1 in 10,000.
Oh, well, I'll sort of get into this, especially with cellular stuff, but that's what we call a selection coefficient. So 10^-4, if it's a deleterious mutation, it means your fitness, scaling everybody else, the mean in the population size to 1, it means your fitness is a fraction, 10^-4 smaller. If it's beneficial, it means your fitness is 10^-4 larger. Scale to the average in the population.
Oh, I see.
So that's where selection always works. It's relative to the mean in the population. Okay?
Okay. Is it also somewhere defined on the upper bound by a standard deviation, or is it just a mean? So
all that matters in evolution is mean fitness.
Mean.
Yeah.
Not the variation.
Well, the variation matters, because if there's no variation, you can select all you want, but you won't get anywhere, because it has no genetic basis. So you have to have genetic variation.
For sure. Sort of assuming a normal distribution, is it?
No.
See, you have used adult primate as a size.
Yeah, and I should emphasize there's 20 orders of magnitude difference of size in organisms here, which I'll be getting into.
Yeah, but some of these organisms are like unicellular, some are like vertebrates. Is there the relationship exists if you look at the cell size of the organisms?
Well, there you go. I mean, these are all unicellular and those are all unicellular. Those are all unicellulars. And I do want to emphasize there's about an order of magnitude around this. So this isn't a deterministic relationship between N, E. There's still a lot of variation among organisms over time and so on. But our mutation rates are pretty good. So I think this variation is real biological variation. It's not just due to our sampling here. Okay, so let's suppose you live up on the top, and I guess there's none of you up here at the top, but you're a bacterial species. And one thing I want to emphasize, this is quite amazing, is even the largest bacteria, even the bacteria with the largest effective size never have an effective population size more than 1 billion. I did a little calculation. I think just to give you an idea how this doesn't relate very nicely with absolute counts of individuals, I believe a pile of E. coli, of 1 billion E. coli would occupy, I think, about a cubic millimeter. Okay, you've probably got more E. coli in each one of you, I suppose. You probably wouldn't be here if you didn't. But that's just what I was saying before, is once you get to large numbers, it's not numbers that really matter. It's all this genetic interference that goes on due to chromosomes. But the good news, if you happen to be a bacterium and your effective size was, say, 10^8, that means you can take advantage of any mutation with effect down to 10^-8. And you can eliminate any deleterious mutation with an effect larger than -10^-8. So all this is saying is, as you get to be a smaller and smaller organism, drift plays a weaker and weaker role, and you can take advantage of many mutations. So evolution can be more fine-grained. You can take advantage of many things we can't take advantage of because the noise in the process is so great. Okay? So that's what we know about effective population size, and it varies by about 3 orders of magnitude. Now, none of this would matter if all mutations had huge effects. If every mutation had effect greater than 10^-4, then selection could see everything everywhere. But in fact, most mutations have very, very tiny effects. And I'm not going to go into any great detail how we know this, but there's lots of ways to get at it. One is, again, from population surveys, like I mentioned, and this just happens to be some of our work from Daphne, and this is called the distribution of fitness effects. So what we're looking at here is, of all the segregating mutations in a natural population, what's their distribution? And here we're looking at this, it's scaled to the effective population size again. So the benchmark here is, if this value is about 1, if you're below that, drift wins. You're effectively neutral. And if you're to the right of this, selection can see you. And the main point I want to make here, and there's many other sets of data like this, is a large fraction of mutations are in this zone to the left. That's what we call effective neutrality. So if you're down there, it doesn't matter whether you're good or bad, selection can't see you. And that has a value of about 10 to the minus 7 is the breakpoint, because NE in Daphne is almost a million. And if you don't like to going through the or thinking about the statistics of where all this comes from, because it probably isn't obvious at this point unless you're population genesis, let me use just a bioenergetics example, since this is a bioenergetics meeting. Suppose you wanted to know the selective consequences of adding a single nucleotide to a genome. So, and the nucleotide's not doing anything good or bad for you, but it's affecting your energy budget slightly. How much? Well, we'll see soon that it costs about 50 ATPs to synthesize a nucleotide. DNA is double-stranded in our case. And so the cost of adding a single base pair to a genome is 100 ATPs, roughly. I'm rounding everything off here. I'm doing the physicist thing, everything off to an order of magnitude. Okay, what does this mean in terms of E. coli? I suppose we're thinking about E. coli. Well, we'll see soon that it takes roughly 10 to the 10th ATP hydrolyses to build a baby E. coli cell. So if you add one base pair to E. coli, the fractional increase in your energy budget is 100 over 10 to the minus 10. So the selective disadvantage in terms of your growth rate is 100 divided by 10 to the minus 10. You would have a selective disadvantage of about 10 to the minus 8. It's quite remarkable because that's right on the edge of the drift barrier for E. coli. So if you're a typical bacterium, if we just add one or two nucleotides to the genome, natural selection could discriminate against you with respect to everybody else in the population. But if you're a big eukaryote, this number becomes many orders of magnitude larger, as we'll see. That stays the same. But a typical vertebrate, you can add 10 to the 4th or 10 to the 5 nucleotides, supposing it's completely neutral. Natural selection, that's a pretty big bioenergetic cost, but relative to your cell and the power of drift, selection can't see it.
I have a question.
Yep.
Why did you divide the 100 by 10 to the power 10 to make it and define it as disadvantage?
Okay, so you're a professor, and you used to work for Intel, right? So you probably made a lot of money. suppose you had to add $100 to your budget. You wouldn't be feeling much pain, but there's a couple of grad students around here, and if we force them to spend $100 on the spot, they'd be probably feeling it. At least grad students at my university would. And so everything has to be scaled by the total energy budget.
Because I was thinking, addition of one, you could also be deleting one. So
yes. Yeah, so you could just flip this around and ask what would be the advantage of deleting one nucleotide that had no function. The advantage would be 10 to the minus 8.
Okay.
So it'd be just the flip side of
yeah,
what I just said.
Saying, what if it's substitutional, that you're adding one and subtracting one? So then the budget, is it neutral then?
Well, this is such a small number compared to this, it essentially doesn't matter. Yeah, you would add it to this, but you know, adding 10 to the 2 to 10 to the 10th doesn't make a difference.
Can I use this argument to understand whether there's a pressure on genome size from bacteria but not from eukaryotes? Does this argument work?
I'm going to get back to that. Yep. So I think I'm going to skip some of this theory right now. I just put this up for Jin and Udo in particular. I think some of there's a lot of theory that goes behind some of this stuff. It's pretty difficult for me to figure it out mathematically. But I think it's closely related to stochastic thermodynamics. So I'm hoping we can have some. These would be like beneficial and deleterious alleles all linked together. And you have a multiplicity problem because if everything's additive, there's lots of ways to have two pluses and two minuses and so on. And then these are transitions between these states and so on. I think I'm just going to skip over this so I can keep moving into the biology. What I do want to say is we do have theory worked out, and I want to sort of hammer home this point of effective neutrality. So let's go back to the simplest case. There's only one nucleotide under selection. There's no interference due to linked factors and so on. And then we've got everything worked out. I think you have to use confluent hypergeometric functions and things to solve, but it can be done. What we're looking at is population sizes. This is the whole range of what we see in biology. And we want to ask, suppose there's a minus allele and a plus, and the advantage is 10 to the minus 4. So here we are. So that's a pretty big selective advantage, actually, for a single nucleotide mutation. And the way there's reversible mutation here. And the way I've set it up is the mutation rate to the plus allele is 1/100th of that to the minus. And that what that will do, if there's no selection, you'll go to a frequency 1/100th. And so way down here at small population sizes, you'd have to be way down here for this. But then what you can see is the population gets larger and larger, you go to this fixation level. Everybody is big, all the population sizes are big enough so selection can grab onto you.
Mike, I think I maybe missed when you say a growth improving allele, is this genome size?
Yeah, I use this slide for other reasons, and I'll actually come back to it because I'm going to show you some growth rate data. But just think of it as a fitness improving allele for the time being. So the plus is good, the minus is bad, and that's the difference in fitness between the two.
Can I think about it like any kind of trait?
Yeah, you can. Yep.
And Mike, so you said the rate of the forward mutation is 100 times the rate of the reverse?
Yeah.
Why would there be such a big difference between...
Well, one reason is that most mutations are, in fact, deleterious. There's lots of ways to break things, many more ways to break things than to fix it. But it doesn't have to be this. It just happens to be what I use for the plot.
Okay, so I'm just thinking like a point mutation, the frequency.
Then it might be 1/4, 3/4, if there's 3 bad alleles and one good
one. Okay, so that's not just mutation, that's mutation and selection?
No, this is just mutation. If things are completely unbiased, the rates were the same, then at low population size, you go to an allele frequency of 0.5, right? But this is just meant to incorporate mutation bias. All I'm trying to show is where are we in the domain of effective neutrality and where drift doesn't matter. So now we go to a selected disadvantage of 10 to the minus 5, and you can see down here, you're almost at that neutral expectation, and it grows really rapidly. And you'll note that the inflection point is about 10 to the fifth. So that's effective neutrality. That's the point at which the effective population size is equal to the inverse of the selective disadvantage. And then we go to one with a really small effect. These curves are just moving to the right. And so now the inflection point is 10 to the sixth. So you have to be, the selective advantage is smaller, you have to have a larger effective size to take advantage of it. So I'm just sort of repeating things that I said before in a more numerical way. Now, that's if selection only cared about one nucleotide at a time, and this is where things get really difficult. That's where I need help with the theory. Suppose everything's tied together on chromosomes, like I said before, everything's linked together. Then the math gets really difficult. You can still write computer simulations and do it. If the population size is small enough, we can work the math out, because at any one point in time, everybody in the population is in one state or another, and you have these long waiting times before flipping from one state to another. But as the population sizes get large, all the different flavors are in the population at the same time. That's what makes things really difficult. But the main thing is going on here is before, these curves were really sharp. And now when things are linked, you can see they're much shallower. So that's what linkage does. It makes natural selection less efficient, effectively. And I'm pointing this out because what the theory predicts is if you had traits that you could study in different lineages across the tree of life, they have exactly the same function, you would predict that they would have a higher level of, say, catalytic efficiency or a lower error rate, whatever the trait you're looking at, as you move to larger and larger population sizes. So the point I'm making is I think the theory is relevant to things we look at in biology. Now, there aren't a whole lot of traits that you can study across the tree of life. right? Everybody does have to replicate their genome, so that's one thing you could look at. Everybody has to grow, so growth rate's something you can look at. What else? Transcription, error rates. We study that. I'm not going to talk about that today, but if you want to go from archaea to bacteria to eukaryotes, you know, you quickly run out of traits you can look at that you sure have the same function in every organism you're looking at.
So, I mean, I guess for the simple problem, one nucleotide, you actually can write down the equation.
Yeah.
Would you mind writing down for us that equation? At some point, maybe not.
Oh, I won't write it down. I'll send you the tech file or something.
Because that looks like just a...
Yeah, as I said, it's got a confluent hypergeometric function in
like
there.
It's like a drift diffusion equation.
Yeah, it's based on diffusion theory, though. That's where it all comes from. Yeah.
But it's discrete, right? Discrete states or...
Well, it's an approximation to the discrete states. Because this really is discrete, right? Frequencies have to be 1, 2, 3 over 2n. So they are discrete, but... folks have worked out the continuous approximation. It works quite well.
And what do you plot there with the steady state or the dynamics of this model, whatever?
Everything I've been showing you so far, that's the mean allele frequency.
Mean.
So there would be variance around that, yeah.
But that mean will actually change with time, or when you plot there's a steady state?
No, it would wander around it. If you go back to my very first slide where I showed those distributions,
right,
that's what it would sort of look like. But you're confined to a narrow domain. So, you know, plus or minus two standard errors might be a band, a narrow band around that.
But that distribution, if you start with the initial distribution, that distribution will evolve,
yeah,
but it will settle to some steady state. What you plot there is the steady state property.
That's right. Okay. Yep. And you'll always, I don't have any frequency dependent selection, so it doesn't matter where you start, you'll eventually get to that.
Yep. And in your model, you don't allow the population to grow itself. Population
right now, itself. Yeah, this is a constant population size. One way of thinking about this is if you were to just sample this population, or say that's the mean frequency of this allele is 0.1. That means if you were to sample the population every million years, you know, for a billion years, 10% of the time it would have the beneficial allele, and 90% of the time it'd have the deleterious allele. That's sort of what it's saying. Okay?
And the environment is just boring, constant, and doing nothing.
Yeah, according to this. I mean, real environments aren't boring and constant. But this is how we start. You can add fluctuating environments and things to this, but you know, it gets noisier. Okay, so now we're going to turn to some data. Now hopefully people have a vague idea, understanding of the drift barrier hypothesis. We're going to think about this with respect to two cellular traits. So one trait we really have theory for how selection operates on it, and that's the mutation rate. So it's good to have high replication fidelity in general because the vast majority of mutations are deleterious. Suppose you have a population of asexual organisms. These are cells, and these are the number of deleterious mutations in the different lineages. And there's always some deleterious mutations out there because everybody's mutating. But now imagine something happens to one of the replication fidelity genes, polymerases, whatever, and this is a mutator cell. And so it now has an elevated rate of input of deleterious mutations relative to these other cells in the population. And so we want to know what will happen over time. It's an asexual lineage. Its descendants are going to build up a mutation load in excess of what these guys have because they have a greater input. They still feel each mutation, they feel the same pain with each additional mutation, but they have the same rate of input, so they reach an elevated equilibrium mutation load. And that's just like the input-output diagram I mentioned before. You can calculate the excess mutation load here. It's just the ratio of the input to the output. And so delta U is the excess rate of deleterious mutations coming in. Each one has a deleterious effect S. So if S is 0.01, that means your selective advantage is 1%. And it takes about 100 generations to eliminate the mutation from the population. So that's the excess number, but how much pain are you feeling? We have to multiply the number by the effect, and a nice mathematical result arises because we have S in the denominator, S in the numerator, the S disappears, And the selective disadvantage of a mutator in an asexual population is simply equal to the elevated genome-wide rate of mutation. It's completely independent of the effects. Because if the effects are low, the number builds up and they compensate. That's likely to be a really small number because there's hundreds of genes, and you might even argue every gene in the genome influences the mutation rate in some sense because metabolism produces things that are dangerous. So that's likely to be a very small number, and that's why selection on the mutation rate can be weak. So I'm going to skip to the final sort of result on this. As I mentioned before, we've measured mutation rates in about 40 or 50 different organisms now. We know their effective population sizes. I showed you that before. And what I'm showing you now is the base substitution mutation rate per nucleotide site per generation as a function of effective size. Moving to the right, so everybody down, I regret to inform you that this is us here. We have the highest known mutation rate per nucleotide site of any other organism out there. These are all multicellular eukaryotes. These are all bacteria. And these are all unicellular eukaryotes. And you can see there's this general negative relationship between the mutation rate per nucleotide site and the effective size. That's completely consistent with the drift barrier hypothesis. As you move to the left, selection is less effective at eliminating mutator alleles and advancing anti-mutators. And you'll note here that unicellular eukaryotes relative to bacteria, the same effective sizes, have lower, this is one of the few things unicellular eukaryotes do better than bacteria, is replicating DNA. And the reason for this is unicellular eukaryotes have larger genome sizes. And remember, the intensity of selection on the mutation rate is proportional to the total deleterious mutation rate in the genome. The more genes you have, all other things being equal, the more deleterious mutations that come in. So that's why we see these results for unicellular eukaryotes. We have some, we work on paramecium. It's got a mutation rate down to about 10 to the minus, close to 10 to the minus 11 per nucleotide site per generation. E. coli is about 10 to the minus 10. And human is about 10 to the minus 8. For human generation. So there's, again, orders of magnitude differences in the mutation rate. Now, this is a, now let's start moving into energetics. This is an energetics meeting. I'm surprised we haven't seen any graphs like this up to now. People have obsessed on this stuff for ages, going back to Kleiber and even before. These scaling relationships between various physiological traits and the size of an organism. So this is a paper by Tom Fenchel, 45 years ago or so. This is just the population rate of growth, maximum population rate of growth, as a function of the size of an organism. And you can, this is going everywhere from phage at one extreme to homeotherms at the other extreme. This is a log-log plot. You can see these are the so-called power law relationships that people love in ecology, and physiological ecology in particular. So that's one sort of scaling relationship. Here's another one that's quite relevant to this meeting. I have no idea what metabolism really means. I don't mean it that way. I don't know what metabolic rate really means in terms of the organism and the organism's fitness and so on. But people have been measuring metabolic rates in everything forever. And so there's tons of data on this. And I don't know, there's probably about 1,000 data points in here, and this comes from a paper by Savage et al. And again, you can see this power law relationship. This is metabolic rate per unit weight in this particular case.
But typically when people say metabolic rate, they're talking about this like heat production or oxygen
consumption. It's usually, probably almost all these are oxygen consumption. Yeah. Okay, so per unit weight in this particular case. So. You know, something you all know, the bigger the organism, the lower the metabolic rate per unit weight. There's interesting debates in the literature about all this stuff. So, and, you know, some people find a scaling law with a power of 0.2, negative 0.25, and, okay, you know, you can relate this to fractal delivery theory. And then others, it'll often, these are just two, they happen to be close to 0.25, but other people do this with different data. and the slope's like minus 2/3. Oh, that must be a surface to volume ratio thing. But you know, about half the values are about halfway between 1/4 and or 3/4 and whatever, 2/3 or whatever. So, and you can see, you might also argue this is not actually, you know, this is a log plot, so there's some significant curvilinearity. But the main point is people have been studying this kind of stuff forever. And we've been working on a different kind of scaling relationship that seems to hold up quite well. So I want to make clear that what I'm showing you here are data from about, I forget, it's about 300 or 400 species across the tree of life. Again, there's about 20 orders of magnitude difference here. And what we're looking at here is what I call the maximum exponential rate of growth. What do we mean by this? This is not a population growth rate. Well, it is for unicellular species because both are essentially equivalent. But for multicellular species, what does this mean? This is the exponential rate of growth, the maximum exponential rate of growth in biomass over for any stage in the organism. All we're trying to do is ask, if you're a different kind of organism, what's the maximum possible rate you can put on new biomass? Does that make sense? Almost always in multicellular species, these rates are coming from the earliest juvenile stages. So in most organisms, it's the early juvenile stages that grow the most rapidly. And Ema and I were talking about this. I was trying to figure out this might be important to you if you want to produce biomass for Exxon or something, you know, for their biofuels or something. What would you use? You probably wouldn't use an octopus or something. You'd be way down here. Just as a reference, cancer is probably the most rapidly dividing human tissue. So these are rates on a scale of per day. And they're scaled to 20 Celsius to try and put everything on a level playing field. I think cancer cells very vaguely would fall somewhere around here. You know, a little bit, they'd be less than one per day if you scaled down to 20 degrees Celsius. So there's several points to make here. So we think, if you go back to these kind of studies, I mean, some of you know this literature, know that these guys get into some pretty interesting and vitriolic arguments. But they're always focused on alternative selection arguments for this pattern. It's always viewed that this is due to natural selection, but you have this one camp who likes fractal delivery theory, another camp that likes surface to volume ratio limitations, and so on. And what we're arguing is that an alternative view that this, we're not ruling this out, but what we're arguing is that an alternative contribution is the drift barrier, because most growth-altering alleles have these very, very tiny effects that big organisms can't promote or eliminate based on their effects. So the way we're sort of looking at this is, so again, this is the size of the organism. This is the effective population size of organisms. We've done a little bit with vertebrates, but getting into homeotherms, these are all ectotherms. So it gets a little messy, but larval fish fall sort of around here, so nothing new really happened.
So the effective population size, is that experimentally, can be determined experimentally? Or just
no, that comes from these surveys of polymorphism, dividing by the mutation rate. And I showed you the scaling relationship between NE and this before. So all I'm doing now is just extrapolating, just to give you a rough idea of where we are.
Line with the negative slope in the brown cloud?
Yeah, so let me go through this. So this is just the regression of all the eukaryotes. These are all different. So for the physicist in the room, these are all different groups of eukaryotes. So yeast is in red. Ciliates are type of are a group of protists with little hairs all over their body that they swim with. Many of these are marine phytoplankton species, or heterotrophs in particular, that aren't photosynthesizing. Rotifers and crustacea, here we have a huge range of variation because we're going everything from little tiny Daphnia that I work with up to lobsters. And mollusks, too, we have a huge range of variation. You can see this pattern holds within and between groups. So all this is, it's the average regression of all the eukaryotic groups. This is just an idealized upper bound. So the way I view that is that's the upper limit to what natural selection's been able to accomplish. Nobody can grow faster than, if you're this size, nobody can grow faster than that. For some reason, this is something to discuss. I mean, what is it that governs that upper limit to growth rate?
So if you plot that, so instead of using mass at maturity, which I know is sort of giving us a proxy for animal size and population size, what happens to the relationship if you plot the mass, the life stage at which you're getting the maximum growth rate? You get like a cloud?
I haven't produced the plot, but it won't change much. Because there's so many logs here that in general it might move points one, maximum two orders of magnitude. So I think everything's still going to hold qualitatively that I want to talk about, but it's a good point.
Well, I was actually wondering if it would maybe strengthen your argument for the drift barrier hypothesis if you
It would make most, it would push most points, I guess, to the left a little bit.
Small. And, but yeah, so.
And bacteria, all the unicellulars, it's not going to do anything to.
Right.
Okay, so this is just an idealized view of the upper limit to what natural selection's been able to accomplish in biology. And why that upper limit resides there is an open question, I think, worth discussing. So the way we're viewing this is that you're going downhill when you go to the right because of this drift barrier. Selection isn't as good at promoting growth-enhancing alleles as it is here. And so you can think about this as this deficit here as being due to the drift barrier. Now, it doesn't have to be, you know, you might want to say this is all just biophysical constraints. But I want to point out, it doesn't have to be negative. In fact, bacteria, the regression's positive. And people puzzled, and we're not the first ones to point this out, but in bacteria, larger bacteria have higher, these are specific growth rates, so it's a log transfer, higher growth rates. And one simple argument is, if you get too small, you're running into a problem with non-scalable sorts of parts of your cell, right? You have to have a cell membrane, so you're stuck with a lipid bilayer that you can't get rid of. And you got to have at least one ribosome, right? You got to have space left for one ribosome. I mean, a good definition of death is you've lost your last ribosome. So way down here, you're just running out of space is the idea that people have to do everything else, to metabolize, okay? But bacteria run in the opposite direction. Okay, so that's where we think about this with respect to growth rate. And I started to throw together data on, those were all for heterotrophs. You can do the same thing with photosynthesizers, and you get the same negative relationship. This is hard to do out here. These are angiosperms, and some of these points are pretty good. They're these little duckweeds where they've measured the whole weight of the plant. But finding, this is why I was asking you, Rob, about can you tell me the weight of the root mass of a tree? There's a lot of herbaceous things we have the root mass for as well. But you know, the main point is it's negative for autotrophs as well as heterotrophs. But there's the heterotroph line. So autotrophs per unit time have lower intrinsic rates of growth. And that sort of makes sense because you're using energy to fix carbon, to reduce carbon. And whereas all the heterotrophs, they're just sitting there eating the carbon that's already been reduced. So that's my sort of view on it. Although the slopes are quite different. Okay, so I want to keep moving on to the energetics part of this talk. So where we're going to go now is to talk about how much does it cost to build a cell energetically. I don't have a huge amount of time, I don't think, so I don't know. Let me just keep going, see how far
I think we have this room for at least 3:15.
Okay, well, I probably shouldn't go beyond there because there's a classical music concert in here, and I want to go to that, so. Okay, cost of building a cell, how much does that cost? And then there's this issue of the appropriate currency to use. What do we even use as our real currency for a cost? And I'm not going to have time to go into detail on this. I was trying to dig around just before I put this talk together today. And I noticed there's a nice, if you want to figure out how you figure out how many ATP hydrolyses it takes to build a cell or anything else, there's this nice thing you can find on the web. Ron Milo is one of the authors on that. So what I wanted to start us just thinking about, I don't have any answers, but I want to just point this out as something to think about. I mean, this is a workshop about energy, but is it energy we should be using as the currency, or is it something else? So I put this together a year or so ago. If you go to microbial physiological work, people grow bugs on bacteria on all kinds of different carbon sources. And you get different growth yields depending on what carbon source you feed them. And so I plotted that. Almost all these data, bacteria almost always means E. coli. There's some Arabacter stuff. And eukaryotes almost means yeast. You're growing bugs in chemostats. And all you're doing is asking, what is the yield of our bug in dry weight relative to the grams carbon consumed? And for these different, I've illustrated a number of, I put some names on for some key carbon substrates. So when you're moving to the right, you're getting substrates that are more and more reduced. And for any, you can just look up the heat of combustion, how much energy you get from just burning a carbon source. And so I plotted that these two things together. And so all I really want to point out is as your carbon source is more and more reduced, you get a higher yield when you grow bugs in chemostats. And then you get to this point here where the heat of combustion is about 10 kcals per gram of carbon, and things seem to level off. And the slope here is about 1. It's a log plot, but the slope is still about 1. So that is suggesting that so here are your source of energy and carbon is the same substance. And so the idea is below this point here, your carbon substrate is energy limiting. And then when you get to the right, it would be carbon limiting. And lo and behold, you know, most people use glucose, and there's glucose. It's sort of right at the pivot point. So maybe we're in the best possible world if you use glucose. We don't have to debate which is more important than the other. But I just put this up here to think about what all this means in terms of, you know, if we're using energy as a measure of organism performance and so on, when is energy important? And then I spent some time also, I used to be a limnologist, studied plankton in lakes, and there's a lot of amazing work done in limnology and oceanography in terms of the elemental composition of cells of different kinds. And I just, this is a extract from some larger tables, but mainly what I wanted to show you is you ask, okay, if you look at just a whole bunch of bugs, and this is averaged over prokes and eukes, prokaryotes and eukaryotes, what is the elemental concentration of these different elements? Up here it's in millimolar, and down here it's in micromolar. And we also, these are almost all marine, so we also know the concentration of the nutrient in the environment. And all we're asking is how enriched are different elements on average in biology relative to what's in the environment. And you can see if it's carbon, it's about 5,000-fold enriched. And these major anions and cations, it's almost isotonic. It's not too different. But N and P is about, you know, 50,000-fold enriched. This is on a molar ratio. And then you get down here, and you know, iron, and these are important metals that are used in certain enzymes. And you can see the enrichment in the organism be over 1,000,000. And so I'm just raising this because, you know, what really is limiting with respect to different organisms? Is it energy we should be using? All the calculations here on that I'm going to talk about are going to be in units of energy. And I don't even know how to do something. You could do it with carbon fairly easily, but you know, if you have to think about how many molybdenums does it cost to make a flagellum? You know, I wouldn't know where to get started. So, anyhow, just something to think about. Okay, so how do we think about what the cost of building a cell is? And this goes back to some really elegant work in microbial physiology years ago. There's not so much done anymore, but most of the data I'm talking about is coming from that work. And this work could easily be expanded in sort of the modern world with looking at parallel changes in transcription and translation in organisms, the whole omics sort of world. But it takes advantage of a chemostat. So if you've got a bug that can be grown in pure culture, you can grow it with a defined medium, and that medium has, you know, one carbon energy source. It's a sterile culture, so your bugs are growing down here, and you have a stopcock here. That's the control valve. That's the dilution rate. They're not always constructed exactly like this will be the overflow. So the beauty of this is with a chemostat, it's a closed system. You know exactly what goes in, and you can measure everything that comes out. You can count the cells in there. So the difference between that and that divided by the number of cells is the consumption rate of whatever you're interested in. And the beauty is you can grow your bugs at different dilution rates. And those dilution rates, by definition, are the cell division rate, right? It has to reach equilibrium. Make sense? If they're growing, cells are growing faster than the dilution rate, you stand back because you're about ready to see an explosion, I guess. And if they're growing more slowly, I mean, if you open the spigot too wide and the dilution rate's too high, if it exceeds the maximum rate of growth, you'll just wash the bugs out. So people grow things at different rates, and then you can plot the resource consumption rate as a function of the growth rate. And these are called PERT plots from one of the guys who first interpreted what you can get out of these data, and it's quite nice. So this is just an example. This would be the glucose consumption rate per cell per unit time, and the slope and the intercept have very simple meanings. The slope, since this is the rate of consumption and this is the rate of growth, the slope is the number of glucose molecules required to make a baby bug. So that's how you can do this. And you can use any kind of carbon source you want, and you'll get different slopes because of the different energy content of the different carbon resources. And then the intercept, that's extrapolated, of course. You don't have something at exactly zero. But the interpretation of that, that's the basal metabolic rate. That's what it takes in terms of burning energy just to stay alive. And there's nothing left over for growth. And people have done this many, many times with many resources with the same bug. And if you're you know, you're an aficionado of that bug, you know how its metabolism works and so on. And so from glucose consumed, if you know your bug, you can know how many carbons have to have gone into making biomass. And the idea is the rest of it was you squeezed ATP out of. And so you can convert this to ATP hydrolyses. And people have done this with a whole bunch of carbon sources for the same bug. And you get about the same answer at the ATP level. And so we summarized the data on these kinds of things a few years ago. And so each point's for a different organism. These are all bacterial species, unicellular eukaryotes, and these are things like carrot cells and HeLa cells. I put those up there. We're not really using them because they're, you know, for multicellular organisms, they're sort of having out-of-body experiences. So, but even they fit pretty well. And a log-log plot again, and these are the basal metabolic rates. And there are three things I wanted to point out here, is that, again, power law relationship, the slope is close to one. So this is basically, the cost of building a cell is basically isometric with cell volume. And what's interesting about this is that it looks essentially continuous between bacterial cells and eukaryotic cells, even though eukaryotic cells have very, very different structures with internal membranes and lipids, which are costly and so on. So this seems to be a general way, this regression, if you have an organism, you know its cell volume, you could at least get a seat of the pants estimate of its total energy budget. This isn't the rate of growth, this is the total number of ATPs to build a cell. And then I'll return to this number in a second. According to this, it takes about 30 billion ATPs to make a baby E. coli. I'll return to that in a second.
Wait, I just want to make sure I understand. So then you're saying that according to this, like the cost per unit volume is essentially constant. Is that the?
Yeah, I guess that's what. Yes, that's what it'd be saying. So the cost of building a yeast cell is roughly 100 times bigger in volume than an E. coli cell. So the prediction would be. The total number of ATPs to build a yeast cell is about 100 times this.
That is very counterintuitive, like you were saying, like, you know, because of all the membranes and other stuff, you might think it would be different. But I guess.
Yeah, well, I'll return to this in a few minutes. I guess everybody can decide what's counterintuitive and not.
I wanted to comment on that just by saying that 85% of the cost is protein synthesis. So I don't agree that eukaryote and prokaryote would intuitively be different.
How do you get that number?
Also, let's see.
That's not strictly true. You're forgetting the lipids.
But lipids,
almost everything would be lipids plus proteins. Yeah. Proteins, call it 50%. Right.
No, I'll argue with you guys. Why don't we make it a debate later?
Okay.
Like, regarding this, like what Dan said, like, is it, how much does the biomass composition vary between different species?
It's not huge, and I'm going to get to the lipid issue in a few minutes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not huge. I think that's what Rob is saying.
I just think it's a certain number of ATPs per nanometer cubed to do biosynthesis.
That's not all the costs, right? And also there's partial costs of having the carbon staying in the systems.
What volume would it take to pack together 30^10 ATP molecules?
What's that?
How much volume would it take to just put them together?
To get this?
Yes.
That's what it takes to build an E. coli cell of one cubic.
Yeah, but just pure ATP.
These are the things that people like Rob and Ron are good at. How much space is 30 billion? These aren't 30 billion ATP molecules. They're 30 billion hydrolyses. So.
This is probably a pretty naive question, but how much energy you get out of ATP hydrolysis does depend on the ADP-ATP ratio because of mass action. So I'm slightly concerned, but maybe this is a naive concern, about using only the number of ATP hydrolyses when we know that the free energy available actually depends on the concentration.
Yeah, that's correct. And there's a lot going on in every one of these points. So as I said, you're kind of vulnerable to the person doing the study really knowing the biology, the bug, and the metabolic pathways that were being used and so on. So everything you say, I think, is correct. And it doesn't look very noisy, which is somewhat surprising.
Do you think it's possible, just as a quick follow-up, do you think it would be possible to break this if you were intentional? Like, if you sort of made it so that energy wasn't the problem, like, in some way provide, design what you're feeding these bugs in a way so that you could be sure in some way that energy really wasn't the problem, and say you were extremely limiting, like the amount of iron or something. Could you make this?
It seems possible, but I think mainly because if you limit organisms by different things, their cellular composition will change, but maybe it still won't change the total number. What you're talking about will change is the growth rate. And this doesn't have time to mention it. This is just the total number of ATP hydrolyses to grow from baby to adult. And if you limit things by other elements, it will take longer to pull this off. Yeah, one thing before I move on.
The ATP, so that's rescaled oxygen consumption somehow, mostly?
It varies from study to study, but in a number of cases.
And what
there
have
even been study? Some of these done in anaerobic environments, based on your knowledge of the metabolism.
And a separate question is what about like warm-blooded versus cold-blooded animals, where there is this jump of an order of magnitude?
Some of these are mammalian cells, but I don't really know what that means. I think carrot cells are up here, but they're not warm-blooded. But so I think what I like about this approach, I mean, if you just go to if you just go back to glucose or whatever is being consumed, I think it's hard to dispute the pattern. But converting it to ATP, I think, is the bigger challenge. So I kind of am pointing this out. So the reason I had to present this is now we want to think about the cost of various things in cells. And we always have to divide by the total cost of the cells. This is always going to be the denominator. So we're going to get into...
For,
Yep. Can you please explain the equation on the bottom of the slide?
Oh, this is the total ATP consumption in terms of hydrolysis per cell division. So that's what it takes to grow. That's just a constant. And this is the additional metabolic cost, and that's time dependent. So this is the metabolic rate per unit time, and so we're multiplying by time. If you're growing at warp speed, this is generally a pretty small number compared to that. But if you're growing really, really slowly, it's almost all over here, because you always have to respire, right?
But these numbers are different units then, so the unit that you're using there is by hour?
Yeah, this would be, I forget what the units were, it's probably by hour, and then this T would be hours.
So that's...
Hours of cell division time.
Right, but that's already two orders of magnitude. Plus the
yeah, that's what I'm saying. So to get this up there, you've got to have about 100-hour cell division time, right?
Okay. That's compared to 10 minutes.
Yeah. So they're generally, if your bug's growing at a pretty good pace and you're unicellular, that's sort of second decimal place stuff.
So yeah. It's even smaller.
Yeah. Okay. So let's now move on to thinking about the cost of building things in cells. This is partly tutorial again. We need to think about different components of cost of traits. We need to think about this thing we call opportunity cost, and then finally converting to evolution. So the way to think about it is there's like, we're going to think about four major costs of a trait. So this might be a flagellum or adding a new membrane in your cell or something. There's energy acquisition, but we're going to ignore that, because we're asking what's the cost post-consumption, so we won't worry about that. But to make things, you have to synthesize the building blocks, the amino acids or the lipids, whatever it is. So we have to, this is all in biochemistry textbooks, that's another gift we've been given, that everybody more or less uses the same pathways for biosynthesis. There's slight variance, but they're remarkably constant. And then we have to figure out how much does it cost to put the building blocks together to polymerize things, and so on. And then there's maintenance costs just to keep you together once you're assembled. And then there's this thing we call the opportunity cost. So all of this stuff can be calculated from biochem books. And in fact, this can too. But all of this would be, you're sort of using ATPs here. Here, you're not using ATPs because you're breaking down glucose into some precursor molecules. And then at some point, you're making leucine. Instead of squeezing everything, you pass all the energy out of glucose, you're getting an intermediate metabolic precursor and sending it down this pathway. And so the opportunity cost is the way we view that, is that's the energy you don't get to squeeze out of glucose because you use part of your glucose as a carbon skeleton.
But like here in this type of scheme, like where do you have like the effect of the thing. So for example, if I was going to think about, use this term to think about the cost of a ribosome.
Yeah.
And then I get rid of a ribosome and then I grow more slowly.
Yeah.
Like where does this, and therefore that impacts the amount of energy I need because I'm not growing more slowly.
Like, yeah, these are just the baseline. That? Hopefully some of this will get cleared up as I go into examples.
Yeah.
But this is basically the, I mean, it doesn't matter how many ribosomes there are. It's still going to cost you the same amount to make an amino acid or a lipid, right? And so there's no time dimension here. These are synthesis costs.
This is only synthesis costs. This is not.
Well, there's a bit on maintenance, and I'll talk about that in a second. Because that can be time dependent.
Yeah, in your cost, do you also consider the reducing equivalents you need?
Yeah.
And you convert that then into...
You convert that to ATP equivalents. Yeah. Okay, opportunity cost. So the basic idea is this. So, you know, you've got glucose, you're breaking it down slowly, and you're using things to make amino acids in some, you know, these amino acid synthesis spin-offs and so on. And then if you're making sort of a leucine or whatever, we can go to a biochem textbook. I'm not a biochemist, so this is really torture to do. But I know some people love this stuff, but you can figure out all the equivalents to squeeze out and make different amino acids. We figured out I'll give you some numbers in a second. But because you diverted this precursor molecule, you can't squeeze out all your the energy you could squeeze out of glucose, if glucose is only used for energy. So those were the ATPs that you could have gotten, and we call that an opportunity loss. So that wouldn't be measured as heat. It's just stuff that you, in terms of energy, that you can't get out. And just to give you an idea, I already talked about the nucleotide stuff. Remember I was talking about two bases, or a base pair in E. coli was 100. That's where that comes from. So all four nucleotides cost about 50 ATPs. These include the opportunity cost. An average amino acid is about 30. Lipids are really expensive. And there's a lot of variation in lipid molecules depending on how long the fatty acid tail is and how saturated and unsaturated. But that's sort of a good ballpark estimate. And I'm going to return to this. Peptidoglycan is stuff that bacterial put in their cell walls. And we're starting to work on cell walls. So I wanted to throw that in there. Okay, what do we mean by a cost? So imagine, I'm going to talk about the cost of a gene now. So imagine, this is just a thought experiment. You have a bug, and you know its fitness with the absence of this gene. And now you put this gene in your bug, and you know, who knows what it's doing. It's DNA, it's transcribing maybe translating. But it's not doing anything for your fitness. And so you could measure your bug's fitness now, and your fitness is down here because it's a drain on you. You're not getting anything ecologically out of it. So that's due to the excess cost of maintaining the gene at all these different levels. And now imagine another, we're still doing the thought experiment, and this is maybe a little harder to think about. Now imagine your gene is doing something for you ecologically. Maybe it, you know, you can run faster or something and avoid predators, but for some reason it has no energetic cost. So that would be sort of the direct advantage. But what really goes on evolutionarily is there's a difference between, this is the cost of building the trait, that's what you would get out of it, and that's what is your net advantage. And if this is greater than this, then the trait's really a drain on you. You shouldn't have this trait, and it would be subject to elimination by deactivating mutations. What we want to know with respect to the drift barrier, is this number here greater than the power of random genetic drift? Now, what about the, and all of this is always scaled by the cost of the whole cell. So the way we think about this in evolution is, so we say the fitness prior to adding the trait or modifying the trait is just one. This is fine, might seem weird, but everything is relative to the mean in the population. So it's fine to just call it one. And then after the investment of the trait, your fitness is reduced by some amount. Okay? And all, there's no ecology here at this point. I'm just trying to find the fundamental cost of adding something to a cell in terms of the drain on your energy budget. And so before we added this trait, that's your energy budget, big C, and then we add this flagellum or something, and now your energy budget to build a cell goes to big C plus little c, right? Because you have to build this extra thing.
Does this implicitly change the population size?
Oh, yeah, that's a... I don't know.
So I guess you'd have to choose...
I wouldn't... It's hard to argue.
Fixed nutrient intake, or fixed nutrient availability, or fixed population.
Yeah, this is where the ecology comes in, because it could make your population size larger, because if it was flagellum and allowed you to go around and find resources you couldn't find before. But right now we're not talking about that, but it's an excellent point. So it turns out that if this additional cost, and it always is in everything I'm going to be talking about, is small relative to this, then this selective advantage is just, this is just the fractional increase in the cost of a cell, right? This is small compared to this, so we can just call this C, big C. And so the selective disadvantage is just the numerator is the cost of your trait, and the denominator is the cost of the cell. Build the cell before the trait. If you have continuous generations, there is a factor ln of the number of kids you have there. And if you're binary fission, R is 2, right? You make two babies, and that becomes the formula. Jordi Marinoff, I sort of did a back of the envelope thing, assuming discrete generation. I don't even think we used an envelope, actually, but we left that off. But if you have continuous generations, there's this nice paper that's like 10 pages of derivations to get back to this equation, but it's in a physics journal, so it must be right, I guess. Okay, so let's think about the cost of a gene. There's three things I want to get through, and I'm going to have to sort of race through this. There's some cute stuff that I wanted to talk about. The cost of a gene, the big thing we've learned in genomics is there's tremendous gradient of genome and gene complexity when you go from bacteria to eukaryotes. So eukaryotes have really complex genes with small coding regions embedded in these gigantic introns that have to be spliced out at the RNA level. We have complex upstream regulatory regions, and bacteria genes are sort of the Priuses of the biological world, nice and streamlined, and little intergenic DNA and so on. And as you go into, these are just plots of genome content versus genome size in different eukaryotes. And all I want to point out is a couple things. So at log scale, these are isoclines here. So if you were on, this is the coding DNA. If you were on that line, that would mean everything you were doing was going into coding. And there's no intergenic DNA. And you could see all bacteria would be down here. Bacteria are always about 95% plus coding DNA. And then once you get to large genomes, that flattens off. And it flattens off because almost all the further growth in genomes is just transposable elements and introns, intergenic DNA, who knows where it comes from, all this excess DNA. And that's one of the big mysteries in genome biology is how did we get to be so unintelligently designed at the genome level? And I think I didn't used to think that this was the only reason, but I've become more and more convinced it's due to the energetics of maintaining genes. And so Jorgi and I spent a lot of time trying to figure out the cost of a gene. And it comes at three levels. So chromosome level, this is DNA level. You got to think about how much all the nucleotides cost when you to maintain the gene. If you're a eukaryote, you got to worry about histones because you got to wrap your DNA around histones. So there's actually a protein cost at the chromosome level. And you have to worry about duplicating your DNA. It costs a little bit to unwind the helix and so on. Transcription, you have to now allow for the synthesis of all the ribonucleotides. There can be multiple transcripts. So you have to multiply by the number of transcripts per cell. You have to put poly-A tails on your transcripts or for uke and intron splicing costs, capping, blah, blah, blah. And then it goes on for protein. So we've accounted for most of the major contributions. The main thing I want to talk about is what the implications are for genome growth. So there's only a few organisms you can figure out the cost of each gene because you need all that information. As you might imagine, E. coli is one of them. We have a lot of information in every gene in E. coli, including the number of transcripts on average and the number of proteins per cell. So these are histograms of all the proteins in E. coli, all 4,000 or so of the proteins in E. coli. And I've broken the cost in the cost of DNA, RNA, and protein. And then the blue line there, I guess, is the total. And this is a log scale. So what this is sort of saying, the modal cost of a gene in E. coli is somewhere between 10 to the 5th and 10 to the 6th ATP hydrolyses per E. coli cell division. Okay? That's sort of what these are telling us. So what are these? Well, remember I told you it cost about 30 billion ATPs to make an E. coli cell. So these numbers up here are nothing more than the absolute cost divided by, it's scaled by the cost of a cell. And so these are equivalent to selective disadvantages of adding a gene if it's not doing anything for you. What are these numbers? Well, E. coli has an effective population size of about 10 to the 9th. That's the drift barrier. And I've been generous and put an order of magnitude on each side. And the main point is here, all of E. coli's genes are way, way to the right of the drift barrier. So bacteria are in a use it or lose it situation. This would be really bad to have, be a gene in E. coli. You'd have a selective disadvantage of, several orders of magnitude. So if the gene's not being used and you're not getting anything out of it ecologically, it should be eliminated. And of course, that's what bacteria do. Bacteria really are in these streamlined genome sorts of situations. So then, what's quite amazing, and I've already pointed this out, is E. coli can feel, natural selection operating in E. coli can feel just a couple of nucleotides being added to the genome. That variant would be outcompeted by the wild type. fairly efficiently over time. Now let's go into two other bugs where we have the right information, yeast and Arabidopsis, the plant and the yeast here. And three things happen. Everything on this scale, everything moves to the right. As I pointed out, you know, everything's more expensive because eukaryotic genes are longer. You've got to wind them around histones, blah, blah, blah. And so these move to the right, but the cost of the cell becomes larger because that scales with cell volume. So the ratio of the absolute cost of genes, when it's normalized, becomes smaller because you're scaling to a larger total energy budget of the cell. But these bugs have smaller effective population sizes, so the drift barrier moves to the right until you get to Arabidopsis, everything's to the left of the drift barrier. And so what this is telling us, if you're a multicellular species, for example, you could add 10,000, 100,000 bases to the genome, and natural selection wouldn't be able to perceive it. It would be an energetic drain, but relative to the total cost of the cell and the power of drift, selection couldn't see it. So there's a whole mitochondrial genome sitting on one of the chromosomes in Arabidopsis just doing nothing. Now, someday it'll get deleted, but so you get the point. And I probably should stop in about 5 minutes. So we've done membrane stuff. So I want to quickly go through. I'll give 4 minutes to each of the final topics. One, membranes, because that's come up repeatedly. And then I want to talk a little bit about the cost of swimming. So this is sort of the highlight of some graphs I'm going to fly by. So there's been this idea that, and you all know one of the things we have as eukaryotes is all these internal membranes. How do we get all this? And what really made us eukaryotic? And there's this hypothesis that's attributed to Nick Lane and Bill Morton that none of us, I'll review in a second, none of most of biology would even be around if it weren't for the origin of the mitochondrion. And there's a lot of things that are forgotten here. So what about the cost of membranes? It turns out that about, let's say 15% on the average of a eukaryotic cell's membranes, internal plus external, about 15% of our energy budget goes to membranes. Well, bacteria, it's about 20%. Smaller cells, you know, larger surface area per unit volume. So we're not really, as much as it might seem to you, we're not really investing that much more in lipids in our membranes. It turns out that, you know, if you want mitochondria, there's all these membranes in mitochondria, internal and external. And now we go back to the cost of making a cellular feature, and about 5% of our energy budget is just making the membranes in mitochondria.
I was just like, are you talking now about the cost of producing one membrane or maintaining one membrane or the total cost?
I'm talking about the cost of building the membranes, yep, the construction cost. And these things go on and on. I'm going to let me jump a little bit here to make the point that I wanted to make. Well, I don't know where that point is that I wanted to make is. So I don't have a whole lot of time. But some of you know about ATP synthase. That's how we make our ATP. And bacteria put ATP synthase on the outside of the cell. And, I mean, ATP synthase itself is the most bizarre way to make energy that I would never have been able to dream up. But, you know, that's what biology gave us. In eukaryotes, all that got moved into the inside of the cell on the inner membrane. So if we can get our inner and outer membranes correct, in the mitochondria. Okay, and one idea is that what mitochondria did was poor bacteria, were running out of surface area to put mitochondria to make more energy. So a way to solve this problem would be to make more membranes inside the cell. And that's why we have mitochondria, so you can then pepper them with ATP synthase. And you've got all this extra surface area. Well, if that's to work, then there ought to be at least as much membrane space on the mitochondrion is on the outer surface of the cell that you otherwise would have had. Otherwise, it's a complete wash. Make sense? Are you really gaining extra membrane? And there's a few bugs that we've been able to put data together on, and that's the one-to-one relationship. That's the surface area of the cell, and that's the surface area of the mitochondrion, and there's a slope of a one-to-one value. Some of them actually lower than the external membrane of the cell. Now, that's only the surface membrane, and there's arguably more on the interior. But that's kind of a bothersome thing too, because it turns out that ATP synthases aren't all over the internal membrane. They're just at the tips of these cristae. So that seems to be a bit of a wash.
But it's like you don't, having just ATP synthase is not enough, right? You have to have the whole electron transfer chain.
Yeah.
Which is located all throughout
that's right.
the membrane, presumably.
Right.
So it's not useless.
But I think the scaling argument would still be made, right? Because that stuff has to be there.
So, I mean, presumably the inner membrane is, I don't know,
yeah.
10 times bigger than just the surface area, making it somewhat more useful. And the surface of the cell can now be occupied by transporters.
Well, presumably it's useful. I'm arguing it's not useful.
No, using this argument.
But I think the energetics argument, I really wanted to show you this slide, but I think I must have accidentally deleted it. Anyhow, there's this great book, Sex, Power, and Suicide, written by Nick Lane. If you found it under your kid's pillow, it's probably okay. Well, not if he wants to become an evolutionary biologist. It's not what you think. Anyhow, what Lane and Martin have felt is that without the mitochondrion, we could have never evolved eukaryotes, because the mitochondria is required for this enhanced power in cells to build everything. And they argue this is the explanation for sex, disease, you know, mental, everything that you can think about with eukaryotes. So I've, for some reason, lost that slide. I'm going to skip over it. I wanted to point out that we've also gotten into cell walls lately, because for some organisms, a big component of the outer covering is not the just the lipids, but the cell walls. And almost all bacteria have a cell wall. So we've tried to figure out what the cost of that is relative to the lipids. So for gram negatives and gram positives, this whole circle would be the whole energy budget. And I think this is the inner membrane, that's the outer membrane, and the extra stuff is the cell wall. So roughly speaking, about 5 to 10% of the total energy budget of bacterial cells is going into the cell wall, regardless of whether you're a gram negative or a positive. Gram positives have much thicker cell walls. They only have one lipid membrane. And this becomes important in thinking about eukaryotic evolution, because most eukaryotes have lost the cell wall, right? Plants are an exception. Fungi are an exception. I think oomycetes might be an exception. But, you know, it's a use it or lose it sort of thing. If you're using 20-30% of your energy budget to build a cell wall, you better be getting something out of it. Otherwise, it's subject to deletion. So I was going to finish up talking about the cost of swimming, something we've just been getting into. Just the cost of swimming. And I'm running out of time, so I wanted to I got to show you this. This is the coolest critter ever, if I can bring it up. There's lots of ways of swimming, of course. This is one of the. This is a real critter. This is real biology. Oh, maybe I can't get it up on here. Excuse me.
I think your computer was disconnected from the.
Oh. Okay. Well, you can come look at it later. And I do need to stop. So we've been studying the cost of swimming. And flagella are really complicated things. Many years ago, the physicists in the room will know this famous paper by Purcell, and he argued that the cost of swimming is trivial, doesn't cost anything to worry about. And I won't go into the reasons, but he's a physicist and figured out how much it should cost energetically to swim. Turns out swimming is incredibly inefficient. With the flagellum, the conversion of chemical energy to mechanical energy is only about 2% efficient. So you have to account for that. We know a lot about everything's gone. Maybe I should just stop, or maybe they're forcing me to stop. I don't know.
The projector is off.
Yeah. Oh. I didn't know that. How long has this been going on? Okay, maybe I'm being given a hint. Let me just say the key things about the cost of swimming is it's quite amazing. We've been able to look at the scaling relationship between the average swimming speed and the volume of cells. And it turns out the average swimming velocity of unicellular species is independent of cell volume if you do it in terms of cell length. So microbes in general swim on average, quite amazing. They're living in low Reynolds number worlds, right? It's like us in maple syrup or worse. And on average, microbes swim at about 15 lengths per second. Michael Phelps swims at about one body length per second, to give you an idea. The final conclusion that I'll just make is that we can calculate the cost of swimming, even assuming that you're swimming constantly, which isn't true, and the cost of making the flagellum. It turns out that the cost of making the machine to swim is on the order of 100 times greater than the actual cost of swimming. So, but the cost of swimming is not trivial, as Purcell argued. It's about 1% of your cell's budget. That would be like having a selective, if it wasn't swimming, wasn't doing anything for you, that's like a 1% selective disadvantage. You'd be gone. And so most eukaryotic lineages don't swim anymore. Even phytoplankton species, most don't swim, but a few do. So I think this just gives us a different perspective of thinking about, you know, why do many lineages lose certain traits and others maintain the traits? You've got to be getting more out of the trait than you're paying to build the trait for it to be maintained. So I'll just leave it at that, because I think the musicians are probably trying to get in here.